All right. April 2nd, 2005. Josh Kelly interviewing George Brown. World War II history interview. All right, George is going to start with some basic questions before the war. What was your life like before the war?
When the war started, I was a senior in high school, and I was raised on a farm, and we were mostly farm life and school.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your family pretty much, they were farmers then, and was going to be your livelihood?
Not really. Farming had got to the point where you had to be pretty wealthy even just to get the land and start farming. No, I had no intention of farming for a living.
All right. You said you were still in school. Where did you attend school?
New Edinburgh, Arkansas. Okay. I was raised in Arkansas.
Okay. Well, did you have any political learnings before the war?
Prior to the war, no. You hear about elections, and in those days, there was President Roosevelt wound up running for the third term.
Mm-hmm.
And not really in a agricultural farm area in a small town. Politics wasn't a big item.
Now, President Roosevelt running for that third term, did you have any feelings about him running for the third time? This was unprecedented.
No, I wasn't old enough to vote, but I was hoping he'd get reelected because he was known so well worldwide, and I pretty much credit him for pulling the country out of the real bad depression.
Mm-hmm. So, how did your feelings, since you really didn't have any political connections, that type of thing, how did they compare to your family's political feelings? Were they politically strong? You know, they have feelings about the...
Well, I think they pretty much was of that same feeling. Really, back then, you didn't have any campaigning that you have now. Of course, there was no television. In fact, radio just became into use.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever remember hearing a political ad even on the radio.
Okay. Do you remember ever hearing Roosevelt's famous fireside chats?
Oh, yeah. I heard his speak to Congress when he said... Day of Infamy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I listened to that.
Okay. Let's see here. Well, what were your greatest daily concerns prior to the war? I mean, you were still in school, so...
Well, my mother had died in Christmas Day of 1940, and my two older siblings was already in the military, and it was just my dad and myself running the farm and the cooking and the whatever, and and that plus school was a full-time job. You didn't really have much time to think about anything else.
Oh yeah. Let's see here. Well, you did mention that you said your older brothers were already in the service.
Yeah, one was in the back then they called it Army Air Force. One was in the they both enlisted in 1939, and the other one was in the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And they too survived the war. The brother in the Marine Corps was shot up pretty bad. He lived through the Guadalcanal thing, got shot up in the Marshall Islands.
Okay.
But he lived to be 79 before he died, so.
Well, since you did have family members in the Army before, what was your family's perception regarding military service?
I think pretty much everybody knew that there was war coming. Of course, you see, Japan was already stomping all over China, and Germany was taking over nations on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the 30, I don't know, when did Germany start their deal? 30, 35 or 36, their buildup was going on. I don't think anybody had any question about sooner or later they would want to take us on.
Well, was there anyone in your family that was a veteran, say, of World War I? No. Any of the major conflicts? No. Okay. Let's see here. So, I mean, was your family against, you know, going to war, you know, enlisting at that point, or?
I think that had my mother, she didn't seem to mind the two older ones getting into the service, mm-hmm. but after the war started, I guess I'm thankful that she didn't be around when all of us was in, because she was a great, she worried a lot,
mm-hmm.
being in bad health.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So, but no, nothing like that.
Well, you said that you're pretty much aware of what, you know, Germany and Japan, you know, their movements and whatnot, taking over countries. What were your perceptions of the war and those particular combatants at the time of the, prior to the U.S. entry of the war?
Well, it was a sad thing to see pictures in the papers and stuff of all the man's inhumanity to man,
mm-hmm.
really at the utmost.
So you were getting information,
oh, yeah.
about battles and, you know, particular atrocities that they were committing, yeah. then?
We had, even a small town, we had newspapers, and of course, when the radio came along.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, even in those early days, it became evident that the Germans were trying to annihilate the Jewish people.
Oh, yeah. And what were your feelings on that? I mean, how'd that make you feel?
I felt hate for the people who were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was probably what enticed my two older brothers of getting involved in the military.
Okay. Well, was there anything about your heritage or ethnicity that affected your perception of those other? Well, where were you and what were you doing when you found out that Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Well, it was Sunday, middle of Sunday afternoon, our time, when they announced it over the radios.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a little old kind of a portable strange-like radio that we could use outside,
mm-hmm.
and that was the first I heard of it. Sunday afternoon on the farm, we had a basketball court, an outdoor basketball court at our place, and
mm-hmm.
all the whole neighborhood was there playing basketball when the announcement was made.
Okay. Well, what was your initial response after hearing it?
I think just surprised that they came so far. I think even our own politicians thought that they might hit the Philippines or Guam or some of those places and not to come as far as they did to mm-hmm. Hawaii.
How did your family respond to that?
Worry and concern.
Yeah. So was it after Pearl Harbor that your brothers entered the military, or were they already in service?
No, they went in 39.
Oh, they went in 39, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So they were already
in. That one brother, see the country that I think knew was coming. He finished his flight training and everything, and he was in Port Moresby, New Guinea. And then my Marine brother was at Pearl Harbor. He was there when the attack hit. He was,
oh, okay.
They were associated between Pearl Harbor and Hickam Field.
Okay.
There was like a Marine thing there, and so he was there for that.
So he was actually there for the tag.
Yes.
Well, we've got your response and your family's response. How did your community respond?
I think pretty much the same.
Pretty much the same.
Yeah. There was most all of the people of age in that community. See, originally they didn't draft anyone under 21.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, when I decided to go in the Navy, and I talked to my dad about it, he didn't have any problem with it, but I had to have his signature.
Oh, okay.
Notarized signature to go in the Navy. And I went in the Navy a few days after I was 18.
Let's see. Well, since you didn't grow up in Montana, you don't really know about, well, maybe it did affect you. Do you know Senator Jeanette Rankin?
Never heard the name.
Never heard her. Well, she was...
she was opposed to the
female senator. Yeah, she was the only woman to vote down our entry to both World War I and World War II. So.
Well, you know, I don't think that we would have been in that much danger if we hadn't gotten into World War I. I don't know for sure about that. I've been seeing the history of it, but World War II was a deal with Japan and Germany also dealing with manufacturing jet planes. Mm-hmm. They were also dealing with perfecting the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
If they had got it first, they would own us now.
Oh, yeah.
And over half of the population would have been executed by now.
So, you enlisted in the Navy then?
Yeah.
You volunteered. Well, why did you volunteer and what were your expectations going into it?
Well, there was choices. You could have Air Force, you could have Navy, you could have Marines, you could have Coast Guard. My thinking about it is that even though you may not have time to eat or to go to bed, at least you had a clean place and you weren't in a muddy mm-hmm. foxhole with mosquitoes chewing you apart or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine being in the jungles with the mosquitoes.
I called my brother in the Marine. I called him. I said, "You're a bush bunny."
So, I mean, did you have any other inclinations that pushed you towards the Navy? I mean, other than that, just having a safe drive.
No, you see pictures of ships and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was never bothered with seasickness or any of the other problems that some people were. But it looked to me like I knew the war was going and it was building fast, and that's why I went with the Navy.
So you've been at sea before then?
No,
somewhat.
Not at sea. We always had a lake on our property, always had boats, and we were close to rivers and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Okay. All right. Well, what were your family and friends' reactions when you volunteered?
Well, everybody was doing it.
Everybody was doing it?
Yeah, and a lot of them waited till they got drafted.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt I didn't. See, if you got drafted, you had no choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least if you volunteered, you could choose where you wanted to go.
You could choose where you wanted to go, and you couldn't necessarily choose the training. They pretty much did that for you. They would do a lot of tests of your knowledge about a lot of things and go from there on if they were going to put you in a place of having to make decisions and being able to catch on how to do the thing, they checked on your IQ and all kinds of stuff, and your grades you had in school.
Okay. So just exactly what you were qualified to go into. Okay. Well, where did you go for basic training?
San Diego.
San Diego. How long were you there?
Well, we were supposed to have been there 12 months, but 12 weeks, but they kicked me out in 9 weeks, and because they were filling up the crew of this brand new destroyer up in Bremerton, Washington, that was still being built. So I was only there 9 weeks, and then, a little more than that, and then I took a 4-week course in anti-submarine warfare.
Okay.
And that was at the destroyer base in San Diego, which is the same area.
What was your training, what you expected out of it, or?
Some yes and some no. This equipment, sonar equipment is what it's called. And I did not know on what principle it operated, because it's all underwater, and seeing the bottom of a ship, very at the lowest part of the ship, there's a kind of a dome thing that has a piece of equipment that actually sends out sound, actual sound, and it hits an object and bounces back, and this gives you the direction and the distance.
Mm-hmm.
If it was coming towards you, the echo that the machine put out would be a higher tone, and if your distance was going away, it would be a lower tone. That's called Doppler.
Okay.
And it was a thing that you were in training with all the time. If you ever got back to any back area, it was training for you and training for the what they call the deck officers. So they would learn how to anticipate where the sub would be and where we would be, so they could get to a point they could drop the depth charges.
Mm-hmm.
And then also part of that training too was with radar equipment. So I had the qualifications of radar, sonar, fighter direction, and ICU called. That's what it wound up being.
Okay. Well, during basic training, did they keep you informed of world affairs at all? What was going on?
Not really. You could pick it up on radio and newspapers.
But they weren't?
It's basically rifle range, marching, swimming, following orders.
Mm-hmm. So how did you feel about being away from home? Was it your first time away from home?
No, I had, it was a wartime. I had gotten out of, we had gone to school on Saturdays because it was a farm community. And I had gotten out in end of March of 42. And I had a friend that worked for the Air Force down in Boca Raton, Florida, and I got a job and worked down there until I was 18 years old.
Okay.
As a clerk.
So it wasn't anything new for you then, being away from
no.
friends and family?
Well, my mother was dead, and my brothers had all left, and I was hoping my dad would get married again, but he didn't get married for another 6 years.
Okay. Yeah. So it was a relatively easy transition for you.
Yeah.
But what do you remember most about the basic training?
It was a team effort. I don't recall anybody sloughing off or not being interested in what you were doing. It was kind of amazing. On the long, they have one 20-mile march with a 60-pound weight on your back, and the ambulance followed us, because the guys who were in a sedentary type of a job or not getting much exercise, they just had to pick them up.
Oh, yeah. They just drop.
I didn't hardly sweat. I mean, it was after being on working on a farm.
Oh, yeah. So you didn't have that problem.
No.
Well, was there something that you liked the most about the training?
I liked it all.
Liked it all?
Well, basically, you're learning how to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Just that simple. And well, that's what the whole Navy is about.
Mm-hmm.
Is learning how to survive.
Yeah, and training, hopefully they're training you to survive. That's.
Yeah.
But was there anything that you maybe liked the least about the training, the marches?
No, I after working on a farm like I did, this was kind of a vacation. Really.
Yeah, but
of course, these are the days before tractors. We had mules and stuff, and your day was daylight till dark, and then after dark, you milked a bunch of cows and fed a bunch of horses and, you know, all that stuff. And so, no, I got more rest in boot camp than I'd had in years.
Did you expect that? What did you do for recreation during the basic training? I mean, did you guys have passes?
They had movies. No, we were not allowed to go into town until just towards the end of the period that you were there. Because once I was in at a sub school, you could go to town many nights you wanted to go to town. And they had bowling alleys, and there was movies every night and stuff. And but mostly, you know, you're pretty busy during the day. You take your shower and you go to bed. Of course, no reason to stay up till midnight.
Yeah. So they'd work you, train you pretty much all day then.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was an all day thing.
From
you were either with lectures or. Manuals or marching type things. You marched everywhere you went with a group.
Oh, of course. Giving you that training to work as a team, stay in a group.
And learning to do what you've been told to do.
Did you meet people from all around the country? And what was that like? Was there big melting pot of people coming together there?
I think the majority of them were from the West Coast.
West Coast.
Oregon, Washington, a few from Idaho. I don't remember one fellow from Utah. But it was pretty much in my part of the area, and also I only knew of one other guy that was from Arkansas. That was that other George Brown.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Both George Browns from Arkansas.
He was from the northern part of the state, and I was from the southern part.
Having so many people from different parts of the country, did it create any tension within the group? No. Okay. I kind of think that all sorts of different people coming together, you'd have different kind of things coming.
They kept you very busy. You really didn't have time to think about that sort of thing.
Okay. Let's see. Well, did your basic training change your previous perceptions about military life, Navy life? No, pretty much.
Pretty much knew what it was all about.
What it was going to be like.
Well, we were told that early in the part, we would be doing this, and then this, and this, and this, and this.
So pretty much they laid out everything for you, what you're going to be going through.
Yeah.
Well, how well do you feel that training prepared you for when you actually got out to sea for combat?
It was, most of it was very beneficial.
Yeah. Okay. Do you feel that you're mentally prepared to go out there and do that?
Oh, I think so.
Okay. And of course, he said, you know, working on the farm, you're of course physically prepared already before you got there. What kind of expectations did you have as you prepared to leave for basic training?
Well, after working for the Army Air Force for those 6 months and being around the military people, you know, you pretty much, there's not that much difference in what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
You learn an early lesson there or on a ship or anywhere is the captain may not always be right, but he's always the captain.
Yeah. There's always that chain of command.
Yeah, and it worked.
You don't grovel up, you grovel down.
Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, just feel free to
talk. But you see, once you get on a ship like that, we're all dependent on each other, and the difference between the commissioned officers and the enlisted people was not that. You didn't go around and salute. I get a kick out of some of these movies. Here they're out in the ship, and somebody's shooting at them, they're saluting everybody. What a crock.
That's definitely interesting how Hollywood portrays history.
They don't have a clue.
Yeah.
They don't. And even to this day, some of those old movies they're showing, it'll be interesting to what movies it comes out of Iraq to see what they're like. But Hollywood has lost touch with the world so far that...
Something about that. Well, how do you feel? I mean, you're pretty much laying out that Hollywood's got it wrong. Compared to what you experienced, how does Hollywood get it wrong? I mean, you said the saluting and
and they always a bunch of gals around there. I didn't see a woman for three years. I heard one voice, a woman's voice, and that was Tokyo Rose. I don't know if you know about Tokyo mm-hmm. Rose or not. And it was kind of fun. We could pick her up with our radio direction finder. In the early days of navigation, if you were getting a message from somewhere, somebody, you could pretty much pinpoint what direction it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, and they had her on a very strong radio channel. I suppose she was around Tokyo. I don't know where she was, but she was good and she was very accurate. She had all the facts.
Yeah. Well, of course, they have propaganda. They want to have everything they can to feed you.
But the amazing thing about it was that we would be grouped in a certain group. Like before we went to the Philippines, we were grouped. This whole armada of stuff was grouped in Hollandia, New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going from there to there. And just we hadn't hardly left the port. And she named every ship in the bunch and where we were going and what we were doing. And she said, we're ready for you.
Really?
Oh, yes. And that wasn't exactly a letter from home.
No. No, I wouldn't think not.
And they came off of close to nullifying that landing. I'll get to that later. I'll show you some pictures.
Okay. Well, after you left the basic training, where did they send you? They send you straight up?
Well, no, I had that 4 weeks of anti-submarine warfare.
Okay.
So I was in there 13 weeks, we counted both schools. I was 9 weeks and then another four.
Okay. So 13 weeks total.
We would go out and practice run on some of our older submarines, and I got to go aboard the submarine.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you feel being on board a submarine?
It was a fun experience.
Did you actually go underwater in it then? Or?
No, you just went and visited with the guys, and then we would go out and do our practice runs.
Mm-hmm.
We would drop things that they would know if they were hit, but it didn't do any damage to them. It was a small explosive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And we did that about every day. We would go out to sea early in the morning, we'd make a run at it. And it was not only training us, but it was training the line officers too.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do everything they could to get out of our grasp and we would do everything we could to keep track of it. Nobody knew ahead of time who was going where.
So how did you feel getting in the submarine? I mean, they're pretty small, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but they're cramped. But after I got on this destroyer, it wasn't much different.
Oh, okay. So those were pretty small, too. Oh, then. Well, that gets to my next question. Well, did you have any ill effects once you were at sea? Did you ever get seasickness? Mm-hmm. You know, able to adjust right away? And that's amazing, because I know when I get out at sea, I'm green. Mm-hmm. I don't have my sea legs. I'm all over the place. You said it was small. Just how cramped were your living quarters?
Well, the size of this destroyer, if I remember right, was 290 feet long. And the amidship, I think it was around 31 feet. In fact, there's a picture over here I can kind of show you. There's a close-up here of the ship. Now, we had living compartments back here. Now, you got to realize that when you're underway, the main deck here is only about 18 inches above the water. So all of your living quarters are basically underwater.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of living quarters there, and of course when you go aboard the ship, you're the down under grade, so you start out there, and then they had living quarters up in this area. The officer's quarters was just kind of underneath the bridge in here. So you got 300 people in there, and you understand the word bulkhead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you say this is a bulkhead here. There would be three bunks there. Now, and then there was lockers. Each one had a locker down here for your clothes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And during the day, and when there's nobody sleeping, whatever, these bunks could be folded up against the bulkhead. But they were so close there, you basically couldn't sleep on your side. You either had to sleep on your stomach or your back. And a lot of times, the water would be so rough, you had to basically, we had kind of a rubber thing. It had clamps on each side. You could put one across your legs and one across your chest, and mm-hmm. then it would throw you out. So that's basically what it was like. The officers had a little bit better deal. They had about two bunks instead of three. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's some perks to having a higher rate.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
So what part of the ship were your living quarters at then?
Being just a first class, just a third class. I started back there over there. The bad part about this, we had two propellers, and it was awful noisy back there because it's whipping away at the water all the time. And as you moved up the line, I started out, of course, as just a seaman, and then I moved up till I was a first class sonar man, which gives you certain privileges, and then I moved to the front.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to work your way up.
Probably slept a little better up front there.
Yeah, yeah. And you're closer to my general, you know what the term general quarters means? That's what you call it. That's when you go to your battle station.
Okay.
Everybody is assigned a battle station,
mm-hmm.
from the cooks to the bakers to the candlestick makers, so to speak.
So,
and my battle station was here on the bridge for the sonar, and the radar was down on down here about deck level. And that's where they had Anyhow, all your navigation and your operating of radar equipment and your everything was run from down here.
Mm-hmm.
This was the nerve center of the thing.
How well did you adjust to your new surroundings?
No, I didn't have any problem.
Didn't have any problem. It was just like every other day life. So when you first got on board the ship, what were your basic duties when you got there?
Well, we were on there for a couple of weeks when they were not quite through with it. Mm-hmm. And then when we got through with it, we went in what we call a shakedown cruise. You go out and practice with your guns, with your radars, with your sonars. Of course, I'd already had to practice with the sonar mm-hmm. down there. But it was mostly for the gunnery department. And also just general battle station type of thing.
Okay.
We did that for a few weeks, and then we left immediately with escorting a bunch of troop ships going to Guadalcanal.
So you were a sonar technician then. Did you have any other responsibilities?
Radar.
Radar.
And ICS. Where was ICS meant for? Information control. Anyhow, my battle station was ICS.
Okay.
That's where the navigator was. That's where the lieutenant commander, or the second in charge of the ship,
mm-hmm.
and the radar equipment, and your plotting, where you would plot. You've probably seen on movies where they got this big plastic thing, and you're making a marks here for the airplanes are and where the ships are and so forth, and who's our ship and who's theirs and so mm-hmm. on. ICS. You ask me? I can't think of what it stands for, but it was just known as ICS.
That's good enough. We'll go from there. How did you feel about the orders you were given, and were you able to follow them easily? I mean,
yeah.
Integrate into it easily.
Oh, yeah.
On board the USS Halford, did you guys see much combat action? I mean, I've got a timeline basically out here.
Yeah, I've got a thing.
But that doesn't really...
I've got a thing that my grandson pulled up here. And we were involved with so much more than this, I don't know, but these were the, we were involved in 13 major.
Okay.
That was there. And I'll give you a copy of this thing if you want it.
Okay. Well, the first engagement that you were involved in, where was it?
Guadalcanal.
Guadalcanal. How did you feel? What was it like?
Well, it really struck home about it because I knew my brother was there. I was pretty sure he was mm-hmm. there because he was in the 1st Marine Division. Okay, this is the early part of 43 here. Okay. We went to we escorted a troop ship called the Lurline with marine reinforcements embarked for Guadalcanal. After arriving at Guadalcanal, she assumed command of the anti-submarine screen and took up station off Lugo Point. In addition to Guadalcanal operation, the beachhead, we supported the beachhead at Bougainville, screening supply trains and participating in coastal bombardments, anti-shipping sweeps, and so forth. You see, the people on the Guadalcanal had a lot of problems. The Japanese had a lot of air force there on Bougainville and, mm-hmm. and New Britain and New Ireland. And they would come down there bombarding our Marines that was on shore there. And it was our part to tell them they were coming, number one. They called it a picket station. They put you out on the picket station. Mm-hmm. We necessarily didn't fire on them because they were coming low. They came quick, swiftly. But see, we had fighter pilots on Marine and Navy fighter pilots on the Guadalcanal, and it gave them time to get up in the air and mm-hmm. be ready for it when they came. So actually, of the whole war, there was more. The largest other air attack that we saw with more planes than down there was actually the Kamikaze.
Oh, okay. So during that engagement, what was it like for you in your station?
Well, it was like no sleep, no rest. Mm-hmm. You stayed at battle stations most of the time.
So it was pretty stressful.
They would call on us to be floating artillery. In other words, the Marines would call on us to pulverize a certain area, and we would get close as we could and just sit there and bang away all night at mm-hmm. it.
Do you have any other particular battle experiences that you can really remember? I mean, any real major conflicts?
One of the major ones was, do you watch the History Channel at all?
I watch the History Channel a lot. I haven't lately. They haven't had much on there that's interested me.
There was a, let's see, how do I do this? I'll do that first before I do this one. We were involved with what they call the Mariana Turkey Shoot. Mm-hmm. See, the Mariana Islands is Guam, Saipan, Tinian. And we were begin with some older battleships that had been sunk in Pearl Harbor, like California, West Virginia, Tennessee, had been redone and sent out there.
Okay.
They were slow, but they were good at salting up the beach. We were doing that, and I do have a sidebar story for you. We were doing that, and lo and behold, we spotted a little boy. He had made a makeshift raft, and he was semaphoring us. You know what semaphore is? You spell out letters and words.
Oh, okay. For us.
And he said he was a Boy Scout of America, and then he'd say SOS, SOS. Mm-hmm. Well, after much, the captain decided to send a small boat over and get him. Mm-hmm. You're taking a chance of the small boat getting blown up and the little kid, too. Mm-hmm. We picked him up, and he said that when we started shelling the beach, the Japanese got all excited. They were considered prisoner of war because his father was a superintendent of schools there. Mm-hmm. And he said they're over there on the beach, and that his dad, in getting out of this one prisoner of war camp, a Japanese had hit him in the back with a bayonet, and he was bleeding very badly. Well, you don't know if this is a trap or what, but we went and got him. Mm-hmm. He and his family, he and his wife, and this little boy, and there was two girls. Mm-hmm. And we kept him aboard ship, and first we had a doctor, and they stitched up his back and stuff, and then we moved him to a larger ship. And I wished I'd have got his name. He was Guamesian, but he was trained in America and was the superintendent of school. And so anyhow, okay, now right after that, the word came that there was a large Japanese force of carriers and battleships coming towards Guam. And so we stopped what we were doing there, and their whole group, we went out to meet them. Mm-hmm. And that day, what all of us ships knocked out of the sky, and what our fighter planes on our own carrier shot out of the sky, we took away 500 planes.
Wow.
And that was probably the next to the biggest slaughter of lives that I know of, but mm-hmm. I will come to another one. This is in my my grandson picked this up, and I will show you this. We when we landed at, we were the second ship in when we went in to land at Lady Gulf. And of course, you
and where is
in
Lady
the Philippines. Gulf? The first one in hit a mine, a sea mine,
mm-hmm.
and blew it up where it couldn't help. So we could say we were the first ship in there. And then they landed, they secured the beach, and actually it wasn't much opposition at first. But lo and behold, we got word that there was a large force coming up from from the south, up through there, mm-hmm. up towards Lady. And we met them at midnight on one of the darkest nights I've ever seen. And just a minute here, I'll show you here. And this thing coming out in living color like this is beyond my belief. I don't know how I did it, but anyway. Okay, I was looking for the halberd spot. Ah, oh, there's another one here. Here they're coming up Sir Gow Straits, and here's Leyte here.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was they lined up with a lot of the old battlefields back here. And as the ships came up, here we are here. It was our job, the three of us, to go down as fast as we could go and drop 10 torpedo tubes.
Mm-hmm.
10 torpedoes. They claimed that ours alone hit it with 7. And it gave us credit for sinking the battleship Yamashiro with 3,000 people on it.
Oh boy.
And that was just a drawing that it came in on this thing. And okay, let's show you a couple of pictures here. See, we did not have, we could not take pictures from the ship. Anyhow, I wanted to show you that here we go, here's what I'm looking at. The group sunk 2 battleships, 4 cruisers, and 13 destroyers,
mm-hmm.
from the Japanese.